Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. As spring gives way to summer, the night sky changes as well, of course, and since it's ever-changing, we always have more to see and, therefore, ergo, more to talk about with Tom Burns. He's back today to talk about tips for stargazing and more. Tom is an associate professor of English at Ohio Wesleyan University, where he teaches writing. He's also the director of Ohio Wesleyan University's Perkins Observatory and writes regular columns about astronomy for the Dispatch and the Delaware Gazette newspapers.
The Gazette. No longer the Dispatch.
Yes, I'm sorry to say. And we've got to get that out of there. Sorry about that. Anyways, welcome to the show, Tom.
It's always a pleasure to be here. Tom's on the radio.
It has not been a great spring for stargazing. When you were here during the fun drive.
Before you ask your question, the billboard for this show mentioned poetry, so I have composed a short poem.
Oh, okay.
Just, in the form of hip-hop.
Okay.
But a big scope, and it sure is funny. Get good view, spent all my money. Thank you. There we go. I'm sorry. I had to do a quick poem.
You were billed as a poet, and
you came through once again. That's the best I can do, however.
Well, you're always such a great friend of WOSU during the fun drives.
Yes.
I promise the listeners.
Well, thank you.
Bring you back, and thanks.
Hi, Tom Burns. Give me a dollar. No, wait a minute. We're not doing fundraising.
I know. We can just relax now, folks. You don't have to turn your dial. Tom's
on.
So
what were we? Astronomy. Well, what we're supposed to be talking
anyways,
about.
Anyways, you know, even when you were on last year, we did happen to squeeze in some discussion of astronomy, mm-hmm. but it turned out to be kind of a lousy spring. I think from that day on it rained or something.
Yeah, but it hasn't rained in several days, and we've had some clear skies. And, you know, June tends to be a little hazy, but on the whole, clear, so it's a good time to get out there with your binos, your binoculars, and look at the night sky.
So what did you see? Have you seen anything in the last month that was particularly interesting, or was it as crummy as...
Oh, no. When you do get a clear night, you have to go out there with the biggest scope you can and look at Saturn. We'll be able to see it through the end of June pretty much over there in the southwestern sky. But if you haven't seen the rings of Saturn, you don't know the majesty and wonder of the universe around you. And with what opportunity we've had up at Perkins, there's nothing that beats that kid, that second grader going up to that telescope, that slow inhalation of breath, and the exit, oh, wow, that will just blow your mind. Even if you've seen the rings of Saturn 1,000 times, they're on this cycle, and the last couple of years they've been practically edge on. Now they're trying to, the rings are starting to open up and are really looking spectacular.
Do they kind of tilt?
Yeah. They change their tilt based on their relative position in their orbit and the way we're looking at them from Earth, because the tilts of the planets as they orbit are a little bit different.
And the rings are composed of gases?
No.
And, okay.
They are.
Okay.
Psst. Don't tell anybody I told you this, Anne. But they're not really rings. They are arranged in rings, but they are a billion trillion hunks of ice, hunks of rock, and hunks of ice and rock mixed together, a few of them big, most of them tiny, the size of grains of sand or even specks of dust. And we have a name for objects like that that orbit around planet. And what would that be?
A satellite.
Yeah, they're satellites. They're moons. What Saturn really has is a billion trillion tiny moons orbiting around it. Better check them out, because they aren't long for this world.
What? Why do you say that?
I say that because they are within a magic limit called the Roche limit, which means that as they orbit, those ring particles, they get a little bit closer and a little bit closer to Saturn every orbit, and eventually they will simply fall in. So check them out, because in a million years, it's going to be too late.
How did they come to be? How did the image of the rings come to be? What are the theories
about
that?
That's an interesting question, because it's something that astronomers simply can't agree on. But most probably, the latest theory is that an asteroid struck a small moon of Saturn. I mean, the whole shebang, counting the two objects, couldn't have been more than 40 miles in diameter. Tiny little moon.
Mm-hmm.
And it shattered into particles that just continued to orbit along approximately the same plane that the moon was orbiting. So you got your rings. And that probably only happened a million years ago. And, you know, such is the nature of the Roche limit, is that those particles are only going to be orbiting Saturn for 2 million years. Now, if you think about that, I mean, if you got a paper cut, you wouldn't walk around the rest of your life saying, I'm the person with the paper cuts. The rings, in effect, will heal themselves after only a very short time, a few days in the life of Saturn, if we compare it to a human life. So Saturn is not, generally speaking, the planet with the bright rings. We just happen to be smart enough to see them during the right time. And in fact, over time, planets like Jupiter, Uranus, Neptune, probably had bright rings, and they disappeared, and they probably will in the future as these events happen. But generally speaking, Saturn is not the planet with the bright rings. It happens to be right now, but that's only for a few days in cosmic time. Cosmic time.
My guest is Tom Burns. He's the director of the Perkins Observatory at Ohio Wesleyan University. If you have a question or comment for Tom, you know we welcome them. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are you going on vacation somewhere this year and want to know what to look, you know, what looks best from where? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we're on Facebook, too. So check out the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if you want and post your comment or question there. You know, I was talking to a guy I walk dogs with sometimes, and his daughter's going to Costa Rica. Is the sky much different in Costa Rica than it is here?
Well, it is for two reasons.
Equator.
One, it's farther south, which means you're going to be seeing the southern sky. I mean, everybody goes down there and they say, I'm going to see the Southern Cross because of that song. But what you really want to see are things like the coal sack, which is this dark, dark part of the Milky Way. You want to see the Milky Way down there. Their dark area in the Milky Way is called the Great Emu, for instance. Ours is called the Great Rift. And you want to see objects in other... You can see the Tarantula Nebula, things like that, naked eye, and other galaxies, satellite galaxies of the Milky Way, like the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds. And, oh, my gosh, it's just a whole different sky, and one that is in many ways more spectacular than ours. The second thing is that Costa Rica doesn't have as many streetlights as, say, an equivalent area of central Ohio does. So you're not only going to be seeing the southern sky, but you're going to be seeing it from relatively dark conditions. And, oh, I envy you. I envy her.
The youth is wasted on the young.
It is.
She's
indeed.
She's just a kid.
If I could afford the time, I'd be in Costa Rica right now, and you'd have to get somebody else on the radio.
Andy in Whitehall, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Burns.
Okay.
It is a, is there anything rarer to see in your backyard that can just, that's harder to find than your common, like, astrological thing, like Little Dipper, Big Dipper, that is rare to find?
Well, there are things you can see from your backyard, depending on where your backyard is. If your backyard is in downtown Columbus, I know exactly how many stars you can see this time of year. Three, because I checked when we went down to Red, White, and Boom a couple of Julys ago. But, you know, there are objects in the summer sky that you can see. The Big Dipper is always a good choice, the brighter stars in the Big Bear, because the stars are relatively bright. And you can see the three stars of the summer triangle, which means you can find those constellations. The constellation Lyra, the Lyre, not that kind of Lyre, not what I'm doing today, the other
L-Y-R-A.
Kind. L-Y-R-A.
L-Y-R-E.
Yes,
okay.
E. or A, I don't know. Anyway, which is shaped like a parallelogram near the bright star Vega, easy to find. And Cygnus, which looks like a cross, which has Deneb in it, that's the other bright star. These are going to be almost overhead by midnight or 1 in the morning, so they're easy to find. And Altair, which is in the constellation Aquila the Eagle, which are easy to find because they have bright stars in them. But if you want to see much else, you're going to have to get out of town, and I do recommend it.
Does
that... Mr. Burns? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Burns. And Ms. Fisher, I am a huge fan of your show.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I guess this is Tom Burns from the Perkins Observatory. All right, the solstice is coming up, 21st. Is that usually when So is
the worst day of the year for me.
Because everybody wants to go to the observatory. And
well, the problem is all that darned daylight. It's the longest day of the year.
So you have to stay up the latest.
Of course, all the days are the same length. It's the longest period of daylight, which means, you know, ironically, it's not the date of the latest sunsets.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're still doing programs at the observatory through the end of June. Then we switch to daytime programs in July. But it's tough. You know, not that I don't like daylight, but when you're out there at 11 o'clock still having a backyard barbecue and you don't have to turn on the lights, let's just say that this is bad for astronomy.
Gosh, I never thought of it that way. The date never changes, right?
Cursed daylight savings time makes it even worse.
Right.
Death to daylight savings time. That's what I say.
I really can't comment. So I won't.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Everybody loves that daylight savings time. Mumble.
So does the date ever change, though, for the solstice?
Well, the solstice is when it is.
Yeah.
It's when the sun reaches its highest point. In the north, and that changes from year to year because the orbit of Earth around the sun is 365 and approximately a quarter days, not 365, but it's always June 20th, June 21st. Sometimes I think it leaks over into June 22nd. And it can happen in the middle of the night. From our point of view, it doesn't. It's just when the sun reaches its highest point in the north, and of course that can happen if you think about it, any time of the day. It's another way of thinking about it. It's the longest period of daylight, but that happens when the sun has the biggest arc across the sky.
Okay.
When the sun is farthest north from our point of view.
We're talking about the sky, preferably the night sky in Tom Burns' case. If you have a question or comment for him, give us
a
call. 614-292.
Not that we don't observe the sun. Sorry, I interrupted the phone number. Oh, dear God.
292-8513. And you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
Among the handful of Green Lawn's Medal of Honor recipients, two of them are honored for their service in the Indian Wars of the 19th century. Stanislaus Roy is one of them. He was cited for carrying water to wounded cavalry soldiers at the Battle of Little Bighorn under the command.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
And you can listen to 89.7 NPR News anywhere, anytime by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click on the Listen Live link on the left-hand side of the page. Listen to local and national news programming online at WOSU.org. And it's 81 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny skies today and a high of 94. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 71. Showers and thunderstorms are likely on Thursday, later in the day, and a high near 90. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking with Tom Burns. He is the director of the Perkins Observatory at Ohio Wesleyan University. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, and you can ask him a question. We had a question from Steve. If there's anything faster than the speed of light within or outside the concept of time?
I would say no. I mean, that, if you look at the equations, which I rarely do. I mean, what simply happens when something with mass goes faster than the speed of light is that the mass becomes infinite, which is, of course, ridiculous. The universe is finite in size to start with. So it's not just that that Einstein made these equations up. They're the law. They're the natural laws of the universe. And that simply tells us that nothing with mass can go faster than the speed of light.
What's coming up this summer that you're really interested in?
Well, I have to tell you, there's always the Perseid meteor shower, although this isn't the greatest year for it. You got to go out for the Perseids. It's the best meteor shower of the year. And this year, it peaks during the dawn hours, August 13th. So you're going to want to go out August 12th, stay up all night. But you're going to start seeing more meteors after midnight, which is, from our point of view, 1:30 a.m.
Okay.
Ask me about that.
Yes.
It's daylight savings time.
Oh, okay.
Again. Partly. And then they will increase in number until twilight spoils the view the morning of August 13th.
And what is the Perseid meteor shower?
It is the best of the year's meteor showers. What's happening is the good old planet Earth passes through this cloud of debris left by Comet Swift-Tuttle, I think, every year at about the same time. And when it does, as it passes through clumps of that debris, we get these bursts of meteors, streaks of light in the sky, which have come to be called a meteor shower.
Do you photograph things in space?
I don't, but a lot of people do. That is, and you know, the beauty of a meteor shower is it's real easy photography. You go to some dark rural skies, you set up your camera. Hey, that's a nice one.
Yeah,
right
on
there.
Our website we have a picture of it.
You set your camera up in a direction. Most people like to set it in the direction of Perseus, but you don't have to. And then you just leave the shutter open. The stars will make streaks, as mm-hmm. you can see on the website if you look, as Earth turns. The stars make the streaks. But in the meantime, there will be a streak going in the other direction, some other direction, which will be brighter or fainter than the stars in that direction. And that is a meteor.
Why is it going necessarily in the other direction?
Well, because the stars are moving in a predictable pattern.
Okay.
The meteors will come from all directions, generally in a kind of starburst pattern from the direction of the constellation Perseus, which rarely follows the line that the stars pattern follow. So you'll look at this after you look at it, after you've done the exposure, and you'll see that there's this streak or two streaks or three streaks, which over the period were meteors that happened as you were exposing. And it's kind of fun to do that because it's easy. You have to get out to dark rural skies or the light from the cities will, over the period of the exposure, spoil the view. And I should say that this isn't the greatest Perseids in the world because it is a full moon night, which means the moon rises at sunset mm-hmm. and sets at sunrise. But you still should see some bright meteors. The nice thing about the Perseids is that there are a lot of them, and some of them, a good percentage of them, are even bright enough to make it through the glow of the full moon.
614-292-8513.
Can't beat those Perseids.
That's the number to call if you want to talk to Tom Burns. He's the director of the Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. www.thegreenlawns.org.
Come on, everybody. Call in. And now it's time to play Stump the Stargazer.
There you go. Stump the Stargazer. That's great. There was a big solar flare on the sun recently. Do you ever look at those?
Oh, yes. Well, what we do with our telescopes at Perkins is we look at solar prominences, which are smaller explosions. I mean, they're only 30,000 miles high. What is that? Four times bigger than the planet that you live on. The kind of flare that we saw is best seen with a satellite with special filters that we don't have. This is where the Internet will be. Yeah, and you know, here's the weird thing about that one. It was only a medium-sized solar flare, an M2, as they're classified, but it looked really spectacular off the NASA website because, you know, they do exposures and then they run them together into a little video, and wowie.
Yeah, that's what it's saying. The headline on from NASA is a really, really beautiful solar flare splashed across the sun.
Yes, and that was associated with a coronal mass ejection, which is a lot of energy coming from the sun. So when you see a big one like that, you often say, you know, it's probably worth going out over the next couple nights, sticking your head out the window and seeing if you see an aurora.
Yeah.
Because the particles tend to take a day or two to get to us, and so it really is worth going out and taking a look.
It says here that it was a three-hour disturbance, and because of the sun's angle, the radiation won't have too much effect on Earth when it rises. But it did mention the aurora, the northern or southern lights. But what if it was at a different angle? What kind of effect could something like that have on the Earth?
What if it's coming straight at us? In that case, you might suffer some temporary disruption of the national volleyball tournament on ESPN. Besides that, the real effect on us is negligible because, thank goodness, we have a very nice atmosphere and, the most important thing, a magnetic field that tends to take that material, shoot it up and down the atmosphere to the poles, and shoot it down through the atmosphere, and that's what causes the aurorae in the first place.
Rick in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm just hoping that Mr. Burns could suggest a resource for how I can find where planets are, what direction they are in the evening, and which ones are up.
Yes, I can, as a matter of fact. I would recommend a subscription to one of the two astronomy magazines, Sky and Telescope or Astronomy Magazine, because there you'll have a nice paper copy designed to be used of the whole sky, designed to be used with a red flashlight, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you want to go the cheaper route, you can go to their websites, and they have smaller star maps that you can print out, et cetera, et cetera. That's where I go.
The point of the red flashlight, of course, is so that you can see it in the dark without
blind
your eyes.
Red flashlights, despite some arguments about this on the Internet, do not spoil your night vision the same way that a white flashlight would. And there's no point in using a star map with a flashlight that spoils your night vision.
I've tried it.
You'll be able to see the star map really well, but then the sky will be completely empty because you've just spoiled your night vision.
I completely tried that. Rick, does that help?
Yes, thank you very much.
All right. 614-292.
Was that a dog? Was that Skippy in the background?
513, I don't know.
Hello,
Heidi
Skippy?
In Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I just want to compliment Tom and you, Anne, for your wisdom in having him on. But Tom,
well, gosh, thanks.
One of the most enthusiastic guests that Anne has, and she has plenty of enthusiastic guests. I just appreciate your enthusiasm, your passion for what you talk about, and your rap was really good as well. I also wanted to comment on the fact that many, many years ago when I was a teenager, I had a Perseid meteor shower party with a friend, and we created our own little meteor shower with little miniature marshmallows tossing at each other, whatever. It was just the greatest yes. memory, laying on the ground.
Flaming marshmallows, yes.
So anyway, I just brought it back, and thanks so much.
Thank you, Heidi. Thanks for that call.
Yes, s'mores go particularly good with the meteor shower, but I do recommend letting the fire die down some. The red light actually will not spoil the, you know, if the fire is red, it won't spoil your night vision that badly. But let it go to embers over the course of the night. You don't want to wreck your view of the Perseids just because you want some s'mores.
We have an email from AJ in Grandview. Asks, how soon will Jupiter be visible just after dark instead of just before dawn? P.S. I love Perkins.
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been waiting for that myself because people come to the programs and they say, I want to see Jupiter. I say, okay, by 4 in the morning we should be able to see it well. Yes, it's still a morning object. But by the end of the summer, it will have migrated to the evening sky enough so that you don't have to stay up all night to see it. By the way, the morning sky is really beautiful right now. We can talk about that later. Right now, the featured object in the evening is Saturn, but Jupiter will get there by the end of the summer.
And how long will it be there?
Oh, a long time.
Oh,
months.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, months and months and months. Thank you, AJ. This is an email from Marty. Can Tom talk about what goes on at the Friday night program? Is your guest the person who does the Friday night program?
Oh,
Tom, is that you?
A shill. Thank you very much. Thanks for calling, Bob. I'll
Checks
pay you
later.
Checks
in the mail, Marty.
no, yeah, Marty. We do these every Friday night, except for July. Then we switch to daytime. Why do we do them?
Yeah, why do that?
Because there is no nighttime in July. You know, nighttime lasts 4 hours in July.
Okay.
We start at 9 this season of the year. You come early if you want to and look around, but we start at 9. Then Tom, almost always Tom, you'll have to... If I don't give the talk, it's because I'm dead or in a serious car accident. Seriously, I love these programs. And I'll give a little talk about either everything you're going to be seeing in the telescopes or everything you would have seen had the skies been clear, and how to find yourself in a pair of binoculars from your own backyard. And then we will either go to the telescopes and thank heaven for the Columbus Astronomical Society, whose members, wonderful human beings and even bigger astro nerds than me, thank
it's
goodness.
Impossible.
No, it isn't. And I mean that as a compliment. We'll be out there with their telescopes, big and small, so that you'll have lots and lots of telescopes to look through besides the big Perkins Schottland reflector. And we'll just keep doing that till the last person falls over or goes home. It's a star party. If it's cloudy, we'll do tours of the observatory, complete with ghost story, if you're good. Now, here's the thing. I mean, people often say, it's cloudy. I can't believe I spent $7 on a ticket. But here's the deal. During the tours, for example, we'll spin the 135,000-pound sheet metal roof with the lights on so that you can see what's happening. Please raise your hand out there in Radio Land. How many of you have a 135,000-pound sheet metal roof that spins around?
Good point.
Well, then this is going to be a first for you then, isn't it? It only costs you $7 for grown-ups and $5 for kids to find out. And I have to tell you, I've never had a complaint on a cloudy night. As a matter of fact, I often had people come up to me embarrassing because they complained as they were coming in and walking up to me and saying, shaking their heads and saying, gee, Tom, I had no idea. This is a fun place to be on a cloudy night. And I promise I will be extra entertaining on a cloudy night, knowing that you are disappointed at the beginning.
You know, the census, there's a census update or what came out a few weeks ago or a few months ago and shows us that Delaware County is the only place in the universe, I think, that's growing in population. Well, only place in Ohio that's growing in population.
Yeah, how about that?
Is that, you know, and it's right, that growth is occurring.
It's flight from Columbus is
right
what it is.
Right there.
Everybody.
They want to come out and see the stars.
Stay where you are, because for every 100 of you that come up, they build a new gas station with lots of lights. I mean, this is what we've had to deal with.
Yeah.
But now, you know, I'd like to think that Delaware has a lot to do, and I'd like to think that Perkins Observatory is one thing. I have to say, though, most of the people who come to our programs are still coming from Columbus.
So there. Email from Brendan. Here's a simple question with, I suspect, a complex answer. How fast is the Earth moving? Considering the revolution around the sun moving around the center of the galaxy, and our galactic movement, I suspect we're moving pretty fast. Thanks, and I love your passion for this subject.
Well, the answer is that there is no answer to that question if you're looking with reference to the universe. That is, you know, if you're talking about the general expansion of the universe compared to the most distant galaxy, we are moving, it's moving, therefore we're moving. There's really no frame of reference at nearly the speed of light at the universe as the universe expands. It's easy to measure that in terms of close objects, for instance. So I think we're traveling about 7 miles per second as Earth orbits the sun, because we can simply look at our position with reference to the sun and the other planets. If you're talking about Earth spinning, for instance, it depends on where you are on the Earth. If you're at the equator, your position on the equator spins at about 1,000 miles an hour. It would knock your hat right off, except, of course, your hat is also moving at 1,000 miles an hour. From our position right here in the studio, we're traveling at about 680 miles an hour. And, of course, if you're at the North Pole, I mean, think about it. You're standing right at that pole where Earth spins. You are moving at one rotation per day as Earth slowly spins. I mean, if you just stood there, you'd see the entire sky once as you were rotating. Do you see what I mean? It depends on where you are and what you count as movement. And on a real level, therefore, they're based on the things that the caller said, you know, we're traveling through toward this galaxy and in the general direction of the constellation Hydra as we move away from as we are attracted by the great attractor, etc. If you factor in all of the elements, there is no answer to that question. You have to pick a frame of reference and compare from there.
You're listening to Tom Burns. He's director of the Perkins Observatory up at Ohio Wesleyan University. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ryland, General Manager of WOSU. There is much discussion today about the future of public media, and while we don't know how the funding battles in Washington or the State House will end, we know you've got the power to strengthen and support 89.7 NPR News. Our fiscal year ends June 30th, and WOSU must raise $500,000 by then to reach our year-end goal. Make your gift at WOSU.org or by calling 866-897-9678. You've got the power to keep 89.7 NPR News strong.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes, Hour 2 of All Sides begins with The Dangers of Internet Personalization, with the author of the book The Filter Bubble. Eli Pariser. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. And on your drive home, catch up on the day's events with All Things Considered. Join NPR's Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, and Melissa Block, along with 89.7's Marilyn Smith, for all the day's news on All Things Considered. Weekday afternoons beginning at 4, right here on 89.7 NPR News. 82 degrees currently and sunny skies today, a high of 94. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 71 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms are likely for late Thursday afternoon, a high of 89. There's also a chance of rain Thursday night, a low of 64. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, and my guest is Tom Burns. He is the director of the Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also Twitter us at AnnFisherWOSU. I'm looking at an article here from MSNBC.com. It says Saturn dances with a double star in night sky.
Parima, yes.
Also known as Gamma Virginis, has two bright component stars. What's a component star, first of all?
Well, we assume that stars are loners, bachelors, because our own star, the Sun, is. But when you look at star after star in the sky, you see that they are really double, triple, quadruple, multiple star systems, kind of like your thumbs twiddling, except, one twiddle might take 150 or 2,000 years, depending on how far away they are. Generally, one star is the dominant star, and then you have a smaller star orbiting. A good example of that might be the Sun and Jupiter. If Jupiter had been nine times the mass, it would have been this little red dwarf star, and it would have been essentially orbiting the Sun. That didn't happen, of course, so we ended up being a bachelor star. That's the actual term that astronomers use, by the way.
Interesting, not bachelorette.
Not bachelorette.
But when we talk about the Sun, we call it...
Please excuse the violently sexist. But traditionally, the Sun is associated with male, and the Moon is associated with the female aspect.
El Sol. Okay, so, gotcha. Yeah.
Yes. So, so Parima happens to be one of those double stars. And I might add, if you arrange it just right and you have a good high-powered pair of binoculars or a telescope with a big enough field, you just might be able to catch the duality of Parima and Saturn at the same time. Saturn will be very small, but you should be able to see the rings. But this is the kind of thing where it's just simply easy to find Saturn, and you just move the telescope up to Parima, and there you found a double star, and it's a pretty one, too.
Marietta, in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was listening about this meteor showers, and it's really fascinating. But the problem is, living in Columbus, where do I go see them? That doesn't involve going out in the boondocks, driving for hours, and then having to skip work the next day.
we're laughing with you, Marietta.
I always... have my excuse ready ahead of time. you drive home, you're getting home about 7 in the morning or whatever, because you do have to drive out to the boondocks, let's face it, although that's not quite so important this year, as I'll explain. I always say, stuff some cotton in your nose. It makes it sound better. That way you don't have to fake. And I'm sick. My cat died. Coffee machine isn't working this morning.
So. You have to go to the boondocks.
Well, that's the thing. If it's clear, the universe does not arrange itself for your convenience. It's clear on a Perseid meteor shower day or night, then you get some sleep beforehand, stay up all night, and do a lousy job at work, or you take some vacation or whatever. I mean, it depends on how much you're into it. But I have to say, if it's it's just not a night you miss if it's clear, because it's the best meteor shower of the year, besides maybe the Geminids in the middle of December, and who wants to go out when it's 10 degrees below zero?
Sorry for the bad news, Marietta, but thanks for the call. We appreciate it. I saw the Perseid a couple times now, once in Aspen.
Oh,
yeah, I know. It was great. It really was fantastic. And then another time when we were camping just out, you know, in, you know, east of Newark.
Yeah, so. You asked about vacations. I am going to spend a week in the Cranberry Wilderness where, you know, if I fall and break my neck, it'll be months before they find the body. I mean, I really want those clear, dark skies.
Where's the Cranberry Wilderness?
It's in West Virginia.
Okay.
And
Cranberry River down.
Yeah, yeah.
Right there. Okay,
yeah. And it's even better than the parks down there, because the wilderness is just, I mean, there's nothing on purpose, you know.
I've
no visitor center, mm-hmm, no nothing. Mm-hmm. It's a wilderness, mm-hmm, and I just cannot wait. I'm taking along my binoculars being too big to carry, and that's all I'll have, and just me and that grand confrontation with the universe I live in.
Tricia in Galena, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Can you recommend a good telescope for an amateur sky watcher?
Yes, I can. How much money do you have to spend?
$400 or $500.
Oh, hey. In that case, yes. I would get, this was going to be my advice, whether you, if you said $20, I was going to be saying buy a pair of binoculars. But I would buy a 6 or 8, or for $500, I think you can get an even 10-inch Dobsonian telescope on a Newtonian mount. How much of that makes sense to you?
I guess it will.
A Newtonian telescope on a Dobsonian. Well, that's the thing.
You said a Dobsonian on a Newtonian.
Yes, sorry.
Okay.
I reversed. A Newtonian telescope on a Dobsonian mount, because you get your most bang for the buck. And there are three elements to what I just said. First of all, there is the Newtonian telescope. That's the one with the big mirror at the bottom that has a mirror up top that sends the image to the side of the telescope where there's an eyepiece that you look through. That is on a Dobsonian mount, which is essentially a gun mount, no fancy doodads and gimcracks that are going to add to the cost of the telescope. And then the main element is the size, the diameter of the main mirror, which is either 6 or 8 or 10 inches in diameter. The bigger the better. The bigger the bucket that you use to gather the light, the more you can see. And with a 10-inch Dobsonian, you got a 10-inch bucket, a 10-inch diameter mirror, just like having an eyeball about 20 inches in diameter. You'd look really weird and you'd fall right over, but you'd be able to see more. That's called the aperture, by the way. If the person selling you the telescope does not know what the word aperture means, run away, because they don't know what they're talking about. Now, please note there's a separate element to add to that. That is a Newtonian mount is a reflecting telescope, as opposed to the one with the lenses. That's called a refracting telescope. And the only reason you're getting a reflecting telescope is you get more bang for the buck. You get more aperture per dollar. Otherwise, the telescopes really don't perform any differently. Now, having said all that, I mean, that's a lot to remember. I always say spend about 6 months looking for the telescope that you actually want to buy. Spend the first month of that looking at various buying guides, looking at finding out what all these terms mean, why one telescope mount is different than another, and what it'll give you, etc. For example, a Dobsonian is not going to find the object for you without adding the special encoders and things like that, which is going to cost you more money. It just, you know, it's a hard thing to do, buying a telescope. But if you do it right and arm yourself with knowledge and buy exactly the right telescope for you, it's like buying a house. It's buying the telescope that will give you joy and pleasure, not just the rest of your life, but your children's lives and their children's lives.
I told you he's poetic. Tricia, did that help? You know, you can listen as well on WOSU.org/allsides. If you want to go back and listen to that again, we have we have an archive. So
born free.
Thanks for the call, Tricia.
My father's a doctor. Sorry.
614-292-8513 is the number to call. And Stephen in Pataskala, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Tom, keep your day job, will you? I mean, your night job. Or just kidding.
In other words, skip the singing part?
That was actually the one that I just did was stolen from Henny Youngman. 1954, a very good year for one-liners.
I think you've been listening to OSU too much, but we'll go beyond that even. What I was going to point out, and I try to impress on people, I asked them what they think the size of the Earth is, the diameter of the Earth. And generally, they think of some huge astronomical value that, you know, that's way beyond Ken, you know, millions of miles, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that being said, you know what it is.
Yeah.
And ask Ann if she knows what it is.
Oh, geez, you know, this is stump the host, huh?
Even if she knew, it still wouldn't mean anything. You know, when I say, and I often tell these kids that the Earth is 8,000 miles wide, any number over 1,000 is, by definition, a big, meaningless number. Therefore, what does that mean? And I always show people. And I don't care whether they're second graders or whether they're seniors or anything in between. I have a volleyball and I have a pinhead. That's the difference. Earth, 8,000 miles wide, size of the pinhead. Volleyball, 834,000 miles wide. That's the difference. You want people to know how big Earth is. You show them a pinhead and a volleyball. And by the way, once you're done, you pace that out. You put the volleyball down, and then you pace out the 33 paces to planet Earth to show them that the universe is not made up of stars and planets. It's made out up of the most wondrous and magical substance there is.
But
nothing.
Now, is the volleyball the sun?
The volleyball is the sun. The pinhead is the Earth, yes.
But look at it this way. Look at it from our perspective. Okay, if you go, what, the space shuttle or the space station is 300 miles above the Earth, and if you look down, I mean, you travel 300 miles in the United States, that's not very far comparatively, but if you go straight up 300 miles and then look down, and you can see from horizon to horizon, I mean, the planet's not that big. We have this idea. When you compare it to the sun, I think they kind of lose that perspective.
All right, exactly.
But
I agree with you, and I can show them a picture of that. Actually, I can't. You can't get a horizon-to-horizon picture from the space shuttle. But they're never going into space, matey. I mean, they're never going to have that experience, probably.
But
I know what you mean. I agree with you.
Uh-huh.
You also have to compare yourself with that pinhead. I mean, you have to give them some sense of how they fit into the picture of the Earth and then how the Earth fits into the picture of a small, underachieving C-minus star like the sun. But the point is, you really have to show it's not just showing the enormous size of the Earth. It's compared to you. It's showing the enormous smallness of the Earth compared to even a small astronomical object like the sun. It's both elements. You have to do both.
Thank you, Steve. It's 8,000 miles. There's the answer. Okay. Nancy in Columbus, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann and Tom. I just had a question given some of the discussion today. Are either of you aware of any government entity or elected official that might be promoting a dark sky initiative. It sounds like it would be something that would have to be regional as opposed to local, but I'm curious if we've heard of anything.
Well, there is a national organization that organizes the local efforts, and that's the International Dark Sky Association. Just Google it, International Dark Sky Association, and by gosh, they are the best. And they started out as a bunch of astronomers, but now you have a bunch of lighting engineers, people like that, who see the advantages of lighting that points down. For instance, hey, I have an idea. Let's point the streetlights down at the street. Anyway, they organize those efforts, and now they have a bunch of lighting engineers who are involved, and we'd be in big trouble. We're getting a lot of help from them organizing the kinds of things that are happening in development around Perkins, for instance.
Bill in Lancaster, we just have about 30 seconds, but I wanted to try to squeeze you in. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to, first of all, my son and I were at the observatory maybe two or three Fridays ago. It was a cloudy night. We still had a great time, so I recommend it to anyone. And I was wondering if they were going, if the observatory was going to do anything next summer for the transit of Venus. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, we're going to be out of town. Because if you want to see the transit of Venus, you got to go about 5,000 miles away to Hawaii. It's not like the last one where I think we could catch a glimpse of it. I can't remember. It's possible that we might be able to catch a glimpse of it in the early morning. But I'll have to find that out. And if there is something, even a small part of it visible, we'll do something at Perkins. But I'm planning on being in Hawaii. Thank you very much.
Wow. Well, bon voyage. Hope we see you before then. Tom Burns, he's director of the Perkins Observatory at Ohio Wesleyan University. Tom, thanks again for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.